91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Love is perhaps the most powerful human emotion. It can thrill, ennoble, sustain, or crush one into despair. Good afternoon, it's Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. In a Topical Currents rebroadcast, we'll speak with New York Times Modern Love editor Daniel Jones. He's the author of Love Illuminated, exploring life's most mystifying subject with the help of 50,000 strangers. Through his New York Times column, Jones has been privy to the deepest personal revelations of thousands of strangers. His book explores the topography and subterranean layers of love. He's been married for 20 years, so has insight into what most everyone strives to achieve. Love lost, found, spurned, and upturned on a Topical Currents rebroadcast after the news.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Well, today we talk about a topic we seldom talk about. Well, maybe men don't. That would be love. But it's the subject of most songs and poetry. It causes both elation and heartache, and we're joined by New York Times Modern Love columnist Daniel Jones. I wonder how you get into that business.
Well, we're going to ask him.
We'll find out later. He's written the book Love Illuminated, Exploring Life's Most Mystifying Subject with the Help of 50,000 Strangers. And Daniel Jones is at NPR New York. Welcome to you, Daniel.
It's good to be here.
Thanks for joining us. So, yeah, before we get to how a slacker became the editor of the Modern Love column, tell us, for those who are unfamiliar with the column, just explain, you know, what it is, how it works, and when it runs.
Sure. So this is a weekly personal essay column that runs in the Sunday Style section of the New York Times. And it is open essentially to anyone who wants to write an important and usually conflict-ridden story about their relationship life and send it in. And they come in at the rate of about, you know, 5,000 or so a year. And I sift through those and go through an editorial process with the writer and publish 52 a year. This has been going on for about 10 years now.
Okay, so getting to how you became this, a former ski instructor, and you say you're shy and not one who liked to share your feelings, mm-hmm. and you were going to be a lawyer. So how did you come to be the editor of this column?
Well, I blame my wife. My wife's name is Kathy Hanauer. She's also a writer and an editor. And early into our family life together, when we had young children, she was facing the conflict that many contemporary mothers and career women face, which is how do you balance it all and have a harmonious marriage and career life and motherhood and feeling conflicted about that and guilty. And anyway, all of her friends were feeling the same way, so she decided to put together a book of essays of women writing about this topic. And this book had the inflammatory title of The Bitch in the House, and it became a surprise runaway bestseller. I guess there were a lot of other women feeling that way, and it backed me into the corner of having to respond with a male essay collection of my own, appropriately titled The Bastard on the Couch. And these two essay collections, especially edited by husband and wife, got an awful lot of attention. And one of the people who sat up and took notice was a man named Tripp Gabriel, who was then editor of the New York Times Style section. And he wanted material like that in Sunday Styles on a weekly basis. And he talked to us about it, about co-editing it as a couple. We agreed, and then my wife backed out not long after that. She was working on a novel, and I was
you were left holding the bag.
I had nothing else going on, so that's how I wound up as the editor.
I once had a lady friend who will go unnamed said that the epitaph on my tombstone would say, "I don't want to talk about it."
You and most other men, I think.
Listen, I just want to say here, Daniel, that you and your wife, Kathy Hanauer, will be reading Dueling Love Stories, I understand, with six other storytellers at the event Lip Service Modern Love this Saturday from the 4th? No, this Saturday the 5th at 8:30 p.m. at the Miracle Theater in Coral Gables. And the tickets are at lipservicestories.com. So when you do the dueling love stories, is it going to be the bitch in the house and the...
Watch it. Well, this time I go first. Management might be listening here.
Yeah, this time I go first, and then she offers a rebuttal of sorts.
Oh, I see. So, well, it seems like love would be sort of an intimidating subject to illuminate, considering it's been dissected, analyzed, explained, examined so much. So what do you hope to add to our understanding with your book?
Yeah, well, that was my challenge with this book. I'd been immersed in this material for so long. 8 years into the column, it had been about 40,000 love stories that I felt had passed through me in one way or another. And I wanted to figure out what this added up to and what I was learning from this experience. And I asked myself that same question: What can I add to it? And what I felt I could add were sort of the synthesizer of stories of what people are doing. What's the real story out there? Not advice, simplistic advice to give to people, but what are people dealing with? What are they wrestling with? What are the trends in how technology is impacting relationships? How do people rationalize having affairs? You know, people act in similar ways in all these sort of categories of behavior. And I wanted to sift through stories I'd published, stories I hadn't, and come to some conclusions about how we were behaving and present that as not, again, advice, but sort of a roadmap through a human life of relationships and not where you should go, but here's where people are going and how they're getting from point A to point B.
While perusing your book, I was thinking about the, is there an evolutionary angle to love that makes us more successful as a species because we have that emotion?
Well, I don't find that. I think one refreshing aspect of love, you know, we're always trying to master things and get better at them, and we improve technology, things, work life gets more efficient. Love doesn't seem to get more efficient. Finding love doesn't seem to get more efficient, no matter how hard we try at it. And the complexity of human relationships remains just as challenging as it was, you know, the conflicts are the same thing Shakespeare explored 500 years ago that we were struggling with. And we think we can do it better than previous generations somehow. And we're constantly stymied by how we still wrestle with making ourselves vulnerable to another person. It's a very difficult thing to do. And then once you have found love, it can be a difficult thing to live with another person and maintain that for 10, 20, 50, 60 years. So these are, you know, perennial problems.
So pretty much, do you find that most people, no matter what their preferences, like struggle with the same issues throughout these 10 years, or has it changed with the kind of the onset of the whole internet thing and people meeting, but do they still have the same issues they always did?
Well, I think so. I mean, as I was saying, with trying to get past the vulnerability phase of relationships, I almost think we're hindered more these days by the opportunities and the lure of technology than we used to be in forming relationships where you really had to meet the person. You know, there weren't a whole lot of ways of meeting someone other than stumbling upon them somewhere. And now we have the opportunity to meet people online, and it's almost, you know, luring people into thinking that they can connect deeply with someone without being together with them. And I see one phenomenon I write about in the book. I talk about connection is how these online relationships where you meet someone on Twitter or on Facebook or on any social networking site, they have the ability to get so deep so fast and race way out in front of any sort of physical understanding of one another. And so often these couples then decide to get together ultimately because it just has to be if they connect so well online, and how often those in-person meetings sort of flame out.
But what about the history of arranged marriages where you don't even meet your betrothed until your wedding night?
I've heard from a lot of arranged marriage couples, and I find this a fascinating comparison. I'm not an endorser of arranged marriage, and it's so funny because I hear from people in the United States often yearning for arranged marriage because they think, oh, please just tell me already. You know, take the choice out of my hands. I'm sick of dealing with this. Just tell me who I should be with. But the arranged marriages that I've heard from those cultures, they start off, they're often successful. There are cultural implications, but, you know, they have a very low rate of divorce. But what's funny is they start off with low expectations, and anything on top of that is a bonus. If you come to like the person a lot, it's a bonus. If you come to love them, you know, you hit the lottery. If you have a harmonious life and a good sexual chemistry, again, it's all upside. It's like buying a stock low and having it rise. And in our culture, we start off with all of that. We start off with chemistry. We start off with love at its peak. And, you know, you've bought the stock at a pretty high point, and it has less upside, and we're much more prone to disappointment as a result.
That's interesting. So having higher expectations actually makes it more difficult than these maybe arranged. Maybe arranged marriages are the answer.
Yeah, I wouldn't go that far. I think there are a lot of failed arranged marriages.
Yeah, no.
It's just that we rely on love to be everything these days in marriage. And it just didn't used to be that way. We used to marry for all kinds of practical reasons or cultural reasons,
political,
religious reasons, economic reasons. Mm-hmm. And now it's all about choosing whoever you'd like and feeling the most love with that person. And it's just it can be a burden, you know, to feel like that's the one thing that has to hold you together.
Hmm. Very interesting. We're speaking with Daniel Jones. He's a contributing editor at the New York Times, and he's edited the popular Modern Love column since its inception in 2004. If you have a story about love or a question about a relationship and you'd like to share, I just want to add here that Daniel says, asking me what I've learned about love is like asking a pickle what it's learned about vinegar. So if you do have a question, watch out. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back. It's about love today and modern love.
Who, of course, had a tempestuous relationship with Ike Turner.
That's right. That's right. We're speaking with Daniel Jones, who's the editor of the Modern Love column in the New York Times. And the name of his book is Love Illuminated, Exploring Life's Most Mystifying Subject with the Help of 50,000 Strangers. So, Daniel, do you often find yourself in the role of a therapist?
Yeah, people seem to expect that of me.
Right.
And actually, the editorial process with writers is very therapy-like. Because I'm, you know, a story will come in and it feels like something isn't being addressed. And it's an interesting story, an interesting angle, but it's really my job to press them for what is that? You know, well, how did you feel about that? And how did the other person react? And so I'm constantly pressing with those kinds of questions, even though I have no therapy training.
Do you find yourself like trying to solve problems sometimes, though? I mean, is that like a natural instinct that you want to make it better when they write you about a complication?
I do not have that impulse.
That's Bonnie's impulse.
Just asking.
Well, it's funny because you always say that men, you know, men are problem solvers and they always want to come up with some solution to the problem. I'm so interested in the problem itself and how, you know, all these people who are sending in stories, the stories implicitly ask questions. And they're almost always not resolvable questions. It has to do with what, how should I go about this? How should I feel about this? And you just can't really answer those shoulds, but we're all asking some of the same questions.
In your book, Daniel, you talk about marital routines. Date nights, dance class, scheduled sex. Ugh, that's so boring.
You know, we didn't used to live so long. the average lifespan, not too long ago, was, you know, in our 40s. So when we marry these days, most people seem to marry in their late 20s. You're really looking at a yawning chasm of decades in front of you. And, you know, you're distracted by the childcare years and all of that if you have children. But there's a lot of time to possibly grow bored with one another. And again, we start off on our wedding day feeling like, oh my God, I'm never gonna lose this feeling. And a lot of people do. The same things that attracted them to that person start to grate. And life is full of routines. Marriage is full of routines. What I poke fun at in the book, in my chapter 7, which is called Monotony, I poke fun at our attempts to break out of the boredom of those routines by loading up the relationship with even more routines, like some of the ones you described. Mm-hmm. Hugging each other 10 times a day for 10 seconds each, making sure you kiss upon parting in the morning and kiss upon meeting in the evening. And if you forget, you got to go get out of your car and go back into the house and get that kiss. So these are ways couples try to bring the spark back. But they're also tender efforts, and just making that kind of effort can have a positive effect on one's marriage.
I just want to ask how submissions break down, if you've broken it down in terms of gender, you know, age, geographical location, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, the submissions represent the readership of the New York Times, and in general ways, in terms of geography and. But in terms of gender, it's about 80% come from women, 20% come from men. The age range is mostly people in their 30s and 40s, I would say. Mm-hmm. And geographically, they come from mostly urban areas, not always, but mostly. And mostly from this country, but sometimes from other countries. And what's interesting is, almost more interesting to me is the readership of the column, which is based on comments and feedback, and from what I can tell, is more equally split between men and women. I get just as many comments and see just as many comments online by men as women. So they're trying to figure it out, too. They're engaged
That's
in this,
interesting.
Too.
How about correspondents who are LGBT?
Well, that has really changed over the years, and that's another perspective I feel like in writing this book that I could bring to it is how I feel like there have been dramatic changes over the past 10 years, and most obvious one being gay marriage, and how fast that has become something that the majority of the public approves of, and how fast it has changed in state laws. And because that has been the out front issue, it has allowed other issues to come to the fore. And I noted that in the first 5 years of the column, I did not get one submission. So we're talking about tens of thousands of essays. I did not get one about a transsexual experience. And I wanted to cover that fascinating topic. And I finally ran an essay that I found in a soon-to-be published anthology by the writer Jenny Finney Boylan, who has written extensively on this topic, and I published that. And in the next 5 years, it really just exploded, and I'm getting essays like that all the time from all different perspectives. And we covered it so many times that I finally had to pull back. But the envelope just keeps getting pushed, and people want their experience represented. And I feel like the column provides a venue for that.
That's kind of interesting because it sounds like the column can actually advance the conversation about relationships of all kinds, and maybe more people can learn to accept different kinds of relationships other than their own when they hear a story from somebody who is transgender, transsexual, or gay even, or whatever.
Exactly. And that's what I've noticed has been a big benefit of the column. It's a column that's increased in readership year after year after year. It's increased in the rate of submissions year after year. And it has that impact. But more importantly, someone telling their own story in their own voice can be a very powerful change agent. It's not an abstract news article about someone undergoing a sex change, or someone being in a gay relationship, or someone forming a family in a way that families weren't traditionally formed. It's a person, as though they're sitting across from you in a coffee shop and explaining to you how they feel about their lives, what the details and struggles of their lives are. And it's harder to dismiss. It's harder to think, oh, well, that's crazy. You know, it allows people to, you know, look upon this person with more compassion and empathy. And in that way, I think the column has begun to generate its own material, because when you read someone's story, and if they're really bearing all in a very eloquent way and powerful way, it urges others to do the same. And I've seen that people will send in their stories thinking, well, here's mine. You know, I really appreciated yours, and here's mine.
We're speaking with Modern Love columnist Daniel Jones of the New York Times. We're talking about his book, Love Illuminated. If you'd like to join in, our number is 1-800-743-9576. First caller, we have Deborah. She's in Miami. Hi.
Hi. My name is Deborah.
Hi.
I'm taking my call. I have an odd question, actually. Can one be in love with two people at the same time?
Should I answer that?
Bonnie?
Sure.
No,
yeah, right. I mean, it can be different kinds of love is what I would say. Daniel, what would you say?
Well, I mean, of course, people are torn to pieces by being in love with two people at the same time, or more than two people at the same time. We all define love on our own terms, and for some of us, it's love may be actually more like lust, and it's just an overwhelming feeling that you have to be with someone, and it can be a real sexual charge, being in love with more than one person, you know, causes more strife in relationships, I think, than almost anything else. And it happens frequently. Then there's the love that you feel for your children, which is a very different kind of love than you would feel for your spouse or with someone you are having an affair with or something like that. So it can take many, many different forms. But absolutely, that agony of being in love with two people, or, you know, you hear from people who, before they are settled in a committed relationship, are trying to decide between two people who they feel like they're in love with both of them, and it feels like such a fraught decision. That's another big driver of conflict.
I'm also thinking, you know, these people are sharing, you mentioned, you know, these intimate details of their life. What do you think it is about you that enables people to trust you and confide in you?
I don't know if they know me, or if they feel like they've come to know me through maybe what I've published or what I've written. I did deliberately go about editing the column in a way that I hoped would make it a trusting environment, and that has to do with responding to everyone who submits, at least with a form note that has their name on it. I had been a writer myself for years, sending things off into the void and never hearing anything back, and I think it's alienating. Mm-hmm. So I wanted it to be a venue where people could trust that if they sent their story in, and often these are the most important stories in the writer's life, and sometimes they're devastating, and to send that off and never hear anything back can really feel like a broken promise. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the ways I've done it, and then just in having conversations with people, not pressuring them. I'm not driven too much by deadlines. I have to have something every week, but I work far enough out where I'm never pressuring someone to say, you know, we got to get this wrapped up right now. So if they're feeling hesitant about something.
Now, 50.
So I work at that.
That's
so 50,000 letters. What's the most common theme, or is there one?
Oh, there are many strains of themes that come up again and again. And those are many of the things that I talk about in the book. How do we trust somebody? How do we trust that when someone acts like they love us and says that they love us, that they really do? Or are they just being polite?
Or you fall in love with a sociopath?
You know, there's that possibility too. Less likely, but still possible. As I talk about in the book, love is often about practical concerns, or relationships are often become about practical concerns. This thing that was founded on, you know, passion and not letting your heart rule, I guess. Marriage and long-term relationships, so much of your time is spent negotiating things. Who's going to watch the kids today? Who's going to earn this much money? I hear endlessly about that kind of just long-term negotiating of relationships. How do we come up with a last name? This is one thing I noted in many submissions, where people are wrestling with this last name issue, and there is no perfect way to have a last name for your family anymore. It seems like now that we've dispensed with the patriarchy. So
there's more than sex and money.
There's more than sex and money, yes, yes.
You just mentioned passion, and I noticed you name 10 aspects of love. You say pursuit, destiny, vulnerability, connection, trust, practicality, monotony, infidelity, loyalty, and wisdom. Why haven't you named passion as one of the aspects of love?
Well, I talk about passion in the book. The column is really about conflict. Conflict is really the driver of narrative. People who want something that they aren't getting is the most basic of conflicts. And people who are passionately in love and everything's hunky-dory, I honestly don't hear from them. they don't have much of a story to tell other than we're happy. And you have to admit, you don't really want to hear from people who've just fallen in love and just want to gush on and on about it. So that kind of passion is harder to write about. It's less interesting to readers. And it's not really what the column is about. It can be about rediscovered passion after you've come through some sort of difficulty. But passion itself is harder to write about.
Hmm. Private Man is his name. Wants to know.
This is an emailer.
An emailer. about
Private Man
about natural gender-based behaviors in the context of love. How are men and women different when dealing with love?
Yeah, well, part of it is evident in who wants to talk about it and who doesn't. And I think men are changing in that way. Let me back up for a second. One interesting phenomenon I came across and that I talk about in the book is who is more likely to feel vulnerable first, or who is more likely to say, "I love you" first early in a relationship. And I was doing some research on this, and there's a study that was done by Penn State University that totally surprised me and totally surprised most, I think it was 80-some percent of the people who then heard about the study, about who says, "I love you" first in a relationship. And everyone had assumed, I think 80-some percent had assumed it would be the woman. And it was not the woman. It was the man who says it 70-some percent of the time, two-thirds of the time, who says, "I love you" first. But the reason they were positing for why this is so is that men feel like the woman expects him to say, "I love you," before the relationship will become physical.
Oh.
And so that if he just says it.
So there's an ulterior motive.
If he just says it, you know, whether he knows he's saying it deceitfully or too early or doesn't really feel it or whatever, he sort of feels like he has to say that, or he's caught up in a moment of wanting more and wanting the relationship to become physical.
What about
and goes ahead and says, "I love you," and then they move on. And then after the relationship is physical is when the woman wants to hear it, and that's when the man doesn't really want to say it anymore.
Oh. What about couples who stay together because they have children, and once there's an empty nest, then it's like, uh-oh, we really don't have that much in common anymore.
Yeah, that definitely happens. And I hear from a lot of couples who are staying together. They almost have this expiring clock on their marriage where they feel like they've sort of had it with each other, or the flame has burned out, and they wait there, but they're waiting. They feel very responsible about giving their children a intact home, as long as, you know, as long as they're not in open conflict, of giving their children an intact home until they're out of the nest, and then they split up, and that happens frequently. On the other hand, I've also heard from people who expect that, and then once their kids are gone, they're surprised by how they're able to find each other again and appreciate each other again, and don't split up and have a stronger marriage than ever.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in with New York Times columnist Daniel Jones, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Sounds like Luis is on a mobile. Luis, hi.
How you doing?
Okay.
Thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead.
The comment that I wanted to make is the situation and the topic that you guys are speaking about today is as complex and as difficult to explain and to analyze as trying to explain derivatives in the stock markets to a second grader. But I think that I'm 33 years old and I've been married for 7 years. And before my marriage, you know, I got to know a little bit about both love and loss. When I finally found the woman that I loved and that I decided to marry, I did it because I was certain and very sure that that was the love of my life. We've been married for 7 years, like I said, but for 4 years or since our third year of marriage, we both became Christians. We've taken different approaches to our beliefs. And now we're at a point in our marriage where we have a good amount of things that we disagree on when it comes to spiritual things. My faith has not been changed, and my love for her has not been changed either, but I'm in that situation. So it is. My question is it possible to have a relationship and to continue in a loving relationship with a person when you have disagreements in certain topics? As important as religion.
Okay, we have kind of a bad connection, Luis, so we'll take your answer off the air.
Thank you.
I like that question a lot. And here's where stories can teach us. First of all, the answer to the question is yes. And I feel like a lot of people go into relationships thinking that love is about peace and understanding and getting along. But relationships that are successful are not always like that. They can be combustible and you can fight. And all of those disagreements, even about fundamental things, once you get past and through each fight, can make the relationship stronger, not weaker. There was a very powerful story that was written by a Columbia University doctor who was a child of divorce, and his wife was a child of divorce. Or not his wife, his girlfriend was a child of divorce. They'd been together for years, and their homes were conflict-ridden growing up. And they found each other, and their relationship was about escaping from that and was about being loving and peaceful with each other. And they'd planned to get married just before his residency, and then she up and left him. I think it was a month or so before their wedding date. And he was devastated, and he went on. He didn't know how he was going to complete his residency and what he was going to do. This woman was the only one he'd found a loving relationship with in his life. And he learned during his years of residency, he saw families, it was a pediatric residency, and he saw families struggling with children with cancer and the stress those things caused and all the suffering that goes on in a hospital and what empathy that taught him. And he saw that how conflict can make bonds stronger rather than weaker, and that a relationship is not necessarily about just getting along really well with someone. It can be more like a bouncing basketball and rough and tumble, as he described it, rather than peaceful. And that was a remarkable discovery for him, and that's how his current relationship is. And he says, "Do we fight? Oh boy, do we fight! But we have a much deeper, richer relationship than I had with my fiance who left me."
Well, then you have the makeup aspect too.
Yeah, you have to. we also, you know, fantasize and glorify this idea of a soulmate as someone who gets us on a very deep level. And if someone gets you on a very deep level, then you're not going to fight. You're not going to have disagreements and all of that. But it's just not true. It's true that some relationships are much more peaceful and without that sort of, you know, combat than others. But people should not bail out of relationships just because they have disagreements about things.
We're speaking with Daniel Jones. He is the editor of the popular Modern Love column in the New York Times Sunday Style section. And we're talking about his book, Love Illuminated, Exploring Life's Most Mystifying Subject with the Help of 50,000 Strangers. We need to take another break. Stay with us.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. We're talking about love in its many complexities with New York Times Modern Love columnist Daniel Jones. And as Bonnie said, he's written Love Illuminated. And we'll have links on our Topical Currents Facebook page as well as the WLRN.org website. Let's take a call. This is Sophia. She's in Miami. Thanks for your patience. You've been on a while. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. This is a great program. I am happily married now for 15 years, but my first marriage was actually a very loving one, but after 10 years, it turned out that my husband was gay. And my question to the guest is how prevalent is this type of situation? This was 30 years ago when I married for the first time. And I know now things are a lot more open, and it may not happen as often as it did before, but I had a question as to how many of these type of situations has he run into.
Thanks, Sophia. Daniel?
Yeah, it's definitely something that I've heard about, and that we have run at least one or two essays about. And they happened more recently than the caller's experience. They met, I believe, in the 90s. And it is something that I would expect would be happening less and less frequently. In some of these cases, the men or the women. There was one in one case of in an essay we published where the woman, not long after getting married, realized that she was lesbian, and that she it was almost the marriage that led her to that realization or understanding. So in some cases it was someone wanting to deny their sexuality, and in other cases it's truly someone who just doesn't know, doesn't know until they, or doesn't admit it to themselves, or I'm not really sure what's going on in their heads. But I would expect that's something that would happen less and less. But the people on the on the hearing end of this news are understandably sort of shocked, and how could I have believed this, and all of that, real hurt feelings.
Mm. I'm just wondering, Daniel, how editing your column has changed your feelings about or your approach to love, or made you a better husband.
Or worse.
Or worse.
I can only answer this question if my wife isn't in the room, because I don't have to watch her roll her eyes at my answer. But I think, and she believes this on some level, I hear from so many women, as I was talking about before, particularly their frustrations in marriage or their just all the things they're struggling with. And It's hard, very hard for women these days, harder for men for some reason than when they're working and raising children, and still feels like there's that imbalance. And I hear from these women all the time, and you can't help but empathize with what they're going through. And it's not just them, but anyone in any situation. I feel like what makes me well suited for this job is I'm very curious about other people's lives. I'd rather read about someone who's unlike me than who is like me. So I really seek out these stories of people dealing with situations that are so different. And the transsexual experience is one of them. One of the most remarkable stories that we've run was about a woman marrying a man who, a few months after they're married, confesses to her that through the support she's given him and the love she's expressed by marrying him, that he really has to face the fact that he feels more like a woman inside than a man, and that if he's going to be true to himself and to her, he would go through sexual reassignment surgery and facial feminization surgery and take hormones, and that he would go down that road, and he hoped that she would stay with him through that, but he understood if she wouldn't. And this essay charts that path about how they went through that, and they are together. This was something like 7 or 8 years ago, and they are together and married and as happy as ever with each other.
Oh.
To understand that kind of a situation from the inside, from someone telling the story, is remarkable, and can't help but make you, I think, make anyone, me or any reader, a more empathetic person.
What is the what differences do you find in the way women and men express themselves? You say it's 80% women are writing the stories, 20% men, but you get equal comments, 50-50. But
right.
What's different in the way they each write about love or the problem?
I find that men often are more careful. They, in terms of not wanting to be judged, I guess, they are more, maybe a little less risk-taking in the kinds of topics they write about. they often can be very self-deprecating, trying to ward off judgment in that way. I don't know if they feel like this is not their domain, so they got to tread lightly. I will say that men have written some incredibly powerful essays for the column. Often men can write very tenderly about fatherhood in ways that that readers really appreciate. The men are somehow feel like this is not as much their domain as women's and go about their work more carefully.
Hmm. Address what you call those who, quote, quash, Q-U-A-S-H.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is in Chapter 7 when I talk about the way people who do lose that sort of feeling of sexual passion in long-term marriage, how they then deal with it. And some sneak around and try to get those needs met elsewhere. And others, as we talked about earlier, try to restore that passion through routines or through spending more time together in certain ways or trying new sexual techniques or whatever. And then there's this third category that just wants to feel okay about it. They want to feel like this is what a long-term relationship is. What I hear about over and over is an imbalance in sexual appetite in couples and how potentially damaging that can be, because it becomes, the gap becomes more the more you obsess about it. So if the man wants sex more than the women, which is what I hear about more often in a long-term relationship, then that pressure makes the woman pull away more, and that makes him feel more rejected, and it can just turn into a vicious cycle. But I think when people, there's often a transition in successful long-term relationships from relying on a feeling of passion to relying on a feeling of appreciation for what you've built up together over the years, for your deep understanding of one another. And it's that, if people can make that transition and say, okay, we're not teenagers anymore, we're not in our 20s anymore, but we've got a lot and we've built a lot, that understanding and embracing of that can keep people together, you know,
well, that's
until they're happy golden years on the porch.
That's a great note to end on, a hopeful
note. We're all happy campers.
Yes. Now. Daniel Jones mm-hmm. is a contributing editor at the New York Times, and he edits the Modern Love column. It appears in the style section of Sunday's New York Times. His book is Love Illuminated, Exploring Life's Most Mystifying Subject with the Help of 50,000 Strangers. Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Thanks.
And that's our program for today. It was a repeat broadcast from earlier this year. That's why we weren't able to take any new calls or tweets or emails. We thank you for joining us. You can find free audio archives at our website, WLRN.org, and more information, links, and more at the Topical Currents Facebook page. That's facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Our program is produced by Richard Ives with technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Tomorrow's program is a big dose of reality. We'll visit with a self-described ordinary woman with two kids and two jobs. She also barely squeaks by each month. After a wildly popular internet post, Linda Torrado has written a book, Hand to Mouth, Living in Bootstrap America. We hope you'll join us for that. Bonnie Berman for Joseph Cooper, hoping your day is a great one. Stay tuned for Here and Now, up next from NPR News.